Good morning, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. I'm going to be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, July 5th, 2026. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, July 3rd. They are the following: the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting on Friday, that number is 23,602. That's 23,602. And for the 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, 23,603. That's 23,603. This morning, A Vision for You presents, At Once We Begin to Outgrow Fear. The spiritual awakened state that we're seeking through, you know, through the working of the steps, the 12 steps, I believe is latent. It's inside us, and it has the opportunity to manifest and express itself. So latent, I don't know these big words, but latent, I learned, means that it already exists. You know, it's something that exists, but has not yet developed. Maybe it's been blocked off, and it's as though it's lying dormant in us, almost like it's hidden until circumstances are suitable for it to develop, for it to sprout up. And I mention that because this entire process of becoming spiritually awakened is actually, for me, a very organic one. I think it's an organic one. It's a natural one. And we're invited to consider that this program of spiritual action is not some theoretical kind of, you know, shoot for the stars type of thing. It's not nearly as complicated as I might have believed it was. And it's worth it for me to consider why this awakened state may be unable to express itself yet, you know, because that was the way it was for me a long time. In other words, why does there appear to be a blockage to alignment with this power, this relationship with a power greater than myself? And I've heard it said that human beings are often of two minds. On the one hand, we're tempted to reveal our true selves, and then there's another mind that wants to conceal. You know, do I reveal, do I conceal? And fear, we're going to talk about today, manifested through things like false pride and image management, it leads me to conceal my true self. And we protect that false self. And yet the 12-step way of life encourages us to reveal, to come to terms with our humanness. And maybe we've heard the idea of like TMI. You've heard of TMI, too much information, you know, too much information, too much revealing. How about TLI, too little information? You know, I was offering too little, too vague, too little information. And the big book tells us in a variety of ways, again and again, that selfishness, self-centeredness is the culprit. It's the very root, the very foundation of our troubles. It wasn't food at all. It seemed to be food. It seemed to be my body size as it got bigger and bigger, and the shame and all that stuff. That seemed to be my problem, but that wasn't my problem at all. You know, egoism that shows up in my character defects, like resentments and fears, create a huge chasm to a blockage to the sunlight of the spirit. It just doesn't flow. I could be aware of it, but it's not flowing. And I like to use a metaphor to describe the process that, you know, leading to a spiritual awakening. You know, it's like a long process of cooling takes place to reach the point where water suddenly freezes, you know, and these changes may be so gradual that they're imperceptible, kind of happening below the surface. And it's only the final stage of the process, what appears to be the sudden moment of awakening, of freezing, you know, that is obvious or experienced consciously. And, you know, and it's kind of like that for me. And on page 45, I'm reminded that our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. We don't so much work towards a spiritual awakening. I mean, we do the work, we take the actions. An awakening will come about naturally when we stop trying to make it happen. And in trusting the 12-step process, we follow the blueprint, we follow the instructions, And in doing that, we kind of allow it to descend upon us. We allow this transformation to happen. When we work the steps, we cultivate conditions that allow flashes of awakening to occur. And I've heard it said too that a dimmer switch, think of a light dimmer switch, it serves as a great metaphor. It illustrates the inner spiritual growth that comes to the spiritually awakened is rarely a sudden blinding flash for most of us. You know, it's rather a gradual illumination. And for many of us, the spiritual awakening is seldom an instantaneous flip the switch from off into on. Instead, it operates like a rotary dial. It gently adjusting the flow of the inner light that comes in. And when we realize that we've always had the potential to awaken, which is our natural state, it was only our clinging to the idea of a distorted self through all these defects of character that our higher power will remove and mitigate and you know what I mean, lessen, prevents us, you know, from becoming awakened. And then we come to truly recognize that God will do for us what we could never do for ourselves. And so joining us this morning to share her spiritual journey with an emphasis on how, you know, developing relationship with the higher power of her own understanding helped her to outgrow fear is Jessica C. from Ontario, Canada. And she's a dedicated member of Overeaters Anonymous who remains committed to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. So it's with great appreciation that we welcome her to the line this morning. Good morning, Jessica.
Hey, Larry. Good morning. And thank you for that incredible introduction. Yes, I am Jessica C., recovered compulsive overeater, and honored to be here, honored to have been asked. And I think I will begin just by saying a prayer, a short prayer that my sponsor just recently shared with me. and that is, God, please empty me of me and fill me with you. So I think I'll just start by talking quickly about my history with compulsive eating. It didn't start out this way, but by the end of my compulsive eating career, I would describe myself as a blackout eater. I was eating such quantities of my alcoholic foods that it would, you know, I would have to fall asleep. I would, you know, go into like a food coma for a couple of hours. You know, I was shutting myself off from the world and, you know, staying home by myself for the entire weekend. So that's what it was like at the end. But it started out for me by being overweight as a kid and as a teenager. I remember when I was 9 years old, I remember being weighed in front of my class. And I was the heaviest girl in the class. And I think that's when I first became aware, like, oh, I'm different here. So I really wanted to have a slim body, look like my friends, be able to wear the clothes that they wore. I wanted it so much. It was what I wanted most in the world. I would look at women in magazines and TV with thin bodies, and it's like I just wanted it so badly, but yet I just couldn't stop myself from eating in a way that prevented me from looking like them. And something I remembered recently regarding my compulsive eating is right before coming to OA, this was 21 years ago in 2005, I was in a car accident, which I caused, which was my fault. I ran through a red light and I hit another vehicle, and I had been binging the night before. And I can really think of no reason that I ran that red light other than, because I don't remember it, the only reason I can think that had happened was because I was still hungover from eating compulsively. The accident happened in the morning. And another thing about that event is I actually forgot. I mean, I remembered that the accident happened, but I forgot that I had been eating compulsively the night before until recently. It was on the date of the anniversary of that event that it just came to me suddenly, like, oh my gosh, that happened because I think it happened because I was eating compulsively the night before. So it's just, to me, it tells me that, you know, that's part of my disease is this dishonesty, which can run really deep, you know, this alcoholic brain that actually blocks out real memories and it obscures the truth about the severity of my disease. So shortly after that car accident, I did find OA. You know, I found a local meeting. I guess I had what I called at the time some stints of abstinence, but I was still eating some of my alcoholic ingredients. You know, I'd gotten rid of like the really obvious things, the desserts and the junk food, fast food, and that sort of thing. But I was still getting an effect from eating volume amounts and also more diluted versions of my alcoholic foods and ingredients, which I wasn't entirely willing to surrender. And so that led to me, eventually led to me getting worse in this program. Yeah, I got worse in this program. I had, you know, I did have like, you know, up to 2 years at one point of abstinence. Again, I was still eating some diluted versions of my alcoholic foods, but life was getting somewhat better on the outside. I lost some weight. I looked more normal. But then, you know, my disease and my lack of surrender caught up with me and I started to relapse. Now I remember this movie that I first watched, and I think it came out around the time I first watched it, which was around the year 2000. And the movie is a really harrowing depiction of addiction. And most of the characters were addicted to drugs, but there was a character in the movie, the mother of one of the drug addicts. She was a compulsive eater. She was a food addict. And I thought it was a really accurate portrayal of food addiction. And I knew when I watched that movie, you know, I was in my early 20s, I knew that I was her. I knew that, like, you know, and there's a scene in the movie where she's watching TV and she's trying to stop thinking about the fridge, what's in the fridge, and she just can't stop thinking about what's in the fridge. And you know, that was me. I just couldn't stop going back to the fridge. And the other part of that character story was that she is prescribed amphetamines by a doctor. And very quickly, she becomes addicted to the amphetamines. She loses the weight, and at first, it seems great. You know, she has like this thinner body, and she gets sort of more status, a higher status with her friends. But it very quickly starts to spiral out of control. And that is part of my story too. When I was, you know, in OA and I was relapsing, my family doctor suggested that I try a medication for binge eating disorder, which I'm sure is used safely by many people. It is a stimulant, but I couldn't do it. You know, it became a whole other problem for me. I very quickly started to abuse that medication. I liked what it did for my personality. It made me really extroverted and really productive at work. I love that. But it was destroying my health. And just, it really accelerated my disease. So it was around this time that I met the man who would become my husband. And this was something I'd always wanted. I really, you know, for me and my compulsive eating disease and my isolation, I didn't have a lot of romantic relationships. But, you know, I finally had the relationship I wanted, but I couldn't stop sabotaging it by continuing to eat compulsively and also abuse the amphetamine. which by the way didn't work that well with my compulsive eating. You know, it would wear off in the later part of the day, and then what would happen is my husband would find me eating his peanut butter and his chips, his potato chips, in the middle of the night. You know, there was one time where, you know, things like chips and peanut butter I could easily replace and he wouldn't notice, so I could get them at the grocery store. But another event that happened was I ate this Christmas fruitcake that his mom only made once a year and that my husband looked forward to having, and he would, you know, being a normal eater, he would just eat a little bit of it throughout the year. But I ate all of it, and that's not something that I could hide or replace. And it was just a really embarrassing event. So it was during COVID. You know, I was still abusing the medication. I was still eating compulsively. Things were getting worse and worse. I even went to the hospital once because of how I was abusing that medication. I'd taken so much that my heart rate just wouldn't slow down. So it was at that time that I finally surrendered to this program. I, you know, gave up the medication. I found someone who I knew was going to take me through the steps as outlined in the big book. You know, those people I always avoided up until that point. I got entirely abstinent, and you know, by a complete miracle, I gained neutrality with food. And I did that by, you know, by working the steps quickly, while becoming entirely abstinent from all of my alcoholic foods, ingredients, and behaviors. And that was, and I, you know, I've released 60 pounds, and that was 5.5 years ago. So yeah, I think maybe now I'll get to the main topic, which is commencing to outgrow fear. And I thought I would, you know, kind of take a case study approach here, and just focus on like a specific time in my life, recent time in my life, where my, you know, and I can be pretty fearful. I think if you know me at all, you know that that's true for me. There's something that happened about a year ago, a situation that occurred in my work where, you know, the fear really got super loud. And I, you know, it was a situation that, while very uncomfortable, has helped me begin to heal a part of me that's really been wounded for a long time, where a lot of the fear comes from, and has really touched on many of the parts of my spiritual recovery that needed to be strengthened. So what happened, this was about a year ago, I was in a job I really enjoyed, but there was restructuring in the, you know, I work for a large company, and some restructuring happened, which is just another way for saying a lot of people got let go, and a lot of the people that were left behind got moved around without really any choice on where they were going. So I was invited to join a different team. I didn't even have to interview for this team, so that was a real gift. And I actually had a lot of pride. So even though I do experience a lot of fear and self-loathing and inadequacy in my disease, I can also get this pride. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, soap operas that I used to watch, or young adult novels, where there was often characters who were identical twins. And one twin for me is the more shy and fearful and timid part of my personality. And then there always was the other twin who was more prideful and arrogant. So I really have these twins in my alcoholic nature. You know, they're two sides of the same coin. There's the self-centered fear on one side and pride on the other. And at certain times in my life, one has been more prominent than the other. But yeah, getting back to this team I was invited to join, you know, I thought this was going to be really easy. You know, I just thought, oh, they're not as seasoned as I am. And I remember even telling a friend that I thought I might be bored in this new role. Now this team that I still report into, I have grown to really love them. I love my boss. They're just a really supportive group of people, but I spent most of my time doing my work for a different team, sort of embedded within that team. I don't report into them, but I spend most of my time doing work for them. So it's just a dynamic that will help the story make sense. So the team that I was embedded in was not a healthy place to be. A very demanding, kind of a bullying workplace culture. Things can, where they got pretty unprofessional and kind of cutthroat, not very welcoming to me at all. And I was coming in kind of expecting, you know, with my pride, expecting the red carpet to be rolled out for me. So it really felt like a shock to the system when I didn't get that at all from this team I was embedded in. And something else that happened is it really exposed how there were some skills, some work skills, and one in particular that I never bothered to become strong in. And that skill is working on like visual design and graphic design, like doing things in Google Slides and PowerPoint. And the reason I never, and this is something that's actually kind of essential for my job, but I just felt like I was never good at it, never naturally good at it. And, you know, I think again, in my alcoholic nature, I've always been afraid to attempt things that I didn't think I could excel in and that I wouldn't get accolades for. And, you know, up until this experience, I'd always found ways around not having to do it too much. You know, one escape route is I would get other people to do it for me, or I would avoid roles where that would be an important skill, which, you know, would reduce my opportunities at work. So the big book says, it asks us to look at how we set the ball rolling with our character defects. And for me, this avoidance of doing things that felt too challenging or that I thought people wouldn't give me praise for, that's how I set the ball rolling. And then it also says in the AA 12 and 12 in step 7, and it says, until now, our lives have been largely devoted to running from pain and problems. We fled from them as if from a plague. We never wanted to deal with the fact of suffering. Escape via the bottle, or for me, food, was always our solution. So that was my escape, was avoidance. And it caused me to feel like a fraud because I wasn't strong in an area that's kind of essential for my job. And I would try to hide that fact that I didn't have the skill. And I think Larry touched on this in his introduction. I would try to hide that fact, which meant I couldn't be my authentic self, which would just increase my separation, my isolation from other people. So it's this avoidance that really compounds my fear. It also keeps my life really small. And, you know, it occurred to me that in my alcoholic way of thinking and approaching life, it always limits my option. It's not expansive. It always contracts. So I was in this new role. It was really demanding. The people around me seemed to be unhappy with me. You know, I felt like I was drowning. And for me, work has always been a big source of validation, and I wasn't getting it. And I was racked with fear. And I was almost constantly in the bitter morass that is mentioned in Bill's story, where he writes that no words can tell of the loneliness and despair that I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. And for me, it was a lot of fear as well. So it was around this time that I met a dear fellow in OA who taught me about surrendering my thought life to God, about surrendering my feelings, including my fear. And she often mentioned that my feelings don't objectively help me see reality. And I started to become more acutely aware of old stories and old lies that I've been telling myself for years, which really, really fed this fear. And the biggest lie is that I would tell myself is that I have to feel differently. I can't be afraid before I can take action. That I have to, there has to be no fear before I can take action. But what this fellow kept reminding me is that the truth is that in order to commence to outgrow fear, I have to take the action that I mostly want to avoid. I have to take the action when I'm feeling the most afraid, when it's the very last thing that I want to do. Because that is the point at which I surrender. Going into the belly of the beast, doing the task that scares me the most, showing up and being an adult, and beginning to submit myself to this process is where I start to be changed. This fellow talked a lot about the dilemma that's mentioned in the Big Book, where our options are we can go on to the bitter end with our disease of compulsive eating, which what it has to offer is a lifetime of suffering, or we can pick up the spiritual toolkit. Both of those options involve pain. They are uncomfortable. But doing the step work, picking up the spiritual toolkit, and seeking spiritual transformation, it is difficult and it can be painful. But when I do that, my pain is relatively short-lived. And it says, again, in the AA 12 and 12, that pain is the price of admission into a new life. And most of the time, I really did not feel like taking the next action. I did not want to do the tasks that I felt like I wasn't good at. I didn't want to be around the people who were unhappy with my work. It all felt too hard. And I realized that there's actually a part of me that prefers to feel the familiar feeling of being afraid or feeling bad, because that's the path of least resistance. That's the old story, the old well-worn neural pathway that, though it feels bad, it's actually the easier path because it's what I'm so used to. It's so easy to get on that path where picking up the spiritual toolkit is the less tread path. It's not well worn. It feels unusual to be on it. I'm not sure what's around the corner. It's more difficult to take that path, even though it leads to peace. That's another lie that my disease tells me, is that you just need, this is too hard. You need to give up. Just keep doing what you've always done, because this other unknown pathway, it's probably not going to work out for you anyways. Yeah, the lie that I would rather buy into, that old lie, another old lie is that I have to do it all myself. I have to get accolades, and if I don't, then I'm worthless. That I might as well not give any of this a try because God isn't going to show up. It's all up to me. I'm so limited and flawed that I might as well just give up. I couldn't possibly let other people see that I'm flawed and that I'm imperfect. That's another lie, is that I have to hide. I can't show people that I'm vulnerable. I can't ask for help. And that, again, just keeps me really stuck in my fear. So I had to start putting down these old lies. I had to actually be abstinent from these old thought patterns. But that's, again, that's really hard. Again, like I said, it takes a lot of effort to put down these fearful thoughts and constantly asking God to remove them. That's what's true for me, is I have to actually constantly ask God to remove these old thoughts and to do the work that feels almost impossible to do. But again, when we do that, we're giving God, for me, I'm giving God a chance to shape and mold me. And I think that's the essence of step six and seven. So in working with this fellow, we came up with this prayer, or she offered me this prayer, that I could say whenever I felt myself being pulled into the bitter morass of fear. And that prayer is, God, I'm surrendering these thoughts and feelings that are misdirecting me, and asking you to take over my brain and help me to do the next right thought or action, though I still feel alone and afraid. So I still say that prayer all the time, and it really, the crux of it is I have to let God take over my thought life. And I have to take action even when I feel alone and afraid. And I would set a timer, and I still do this, set a timer for 15 minutes, and I would say that prayer every 15 minutes, and just continuing to take the next right thought or action. And that's where, again, I commenced to outgrow fear. And with this prayer, I started to surrender another old lie that I can't let others see me make mistakes or look incompetent. I had to start believing that God is bigger than my mistakes, because a lot of the anxiety comes from that I'm doing this all by myself. Again, that it's just me, very finite me and limited me here. Again, that isn't true. The truth is that when I do submit myself to this work, that God keeps showing up. I can be so fearful that God won't show up. And if God does show up, he won't be enough. I had to actually start praying to become more spiritually sensitive and to become aware of where God is showing up. Because another part of my disease is I can get so entitled and I can have such high expectations, that it seems like God, God is showing up for me, but I miss it because I expect the heavens to open up and the sea to part. I want something like extraordinary to happen. I have this alcoholic brain that really craves excitement and drama. But then I miss God's daily miracles. So when I surrender and when this entitlement and I pray to become more sensitive to where God is showing up in my life, this is where I start to see signs that God really is showing up. God is enough. God really loves me and wants to restore me to sanity, not just with the food, but with my fear. So I wanted to talk about some examples of where God has showed up for me in this scenario. So the person who I took over for in this job, he's very good at visual design and designing slides. And normally in my company, when you sort of take over for somebody, the person who had the job before, they're just gone. Like, they're not really available to help you transition into the new role. But that wasn't the case. This person, my predecessor, has been very generous with me. And she really helped me learn more about, visual design. And she continues to be really supportive. Another thing that happened is a couple of years ago, my husband bought me some gift certificates to do drawing lessons at an art school. And I gave it a try and it was okay, but I didn't use all of the lessons. And I have the gift certificate pinned to my cork board next to my desk, but I kind of forgot about it. But I was talking to my husband about, this challenge at work where I wasn't very good at, graphic design. And he said, why don't you call that art school back and see that maybe they can teach you some things. And, when I'd been there before, I was like painting and, drawing with a pencil. So I wasn't sure if they could offer lessons in that area, but they could. They actually could. And so something I didn't even have to pay for because I still had some of these lessons left over from my husband's gift to me. So that really helped. My sponsor, my beloved sponsor, she goes through some of the same challenges with work. And we regularly go over our disturbances and apply spiritual principles when they come up. And I have gotten so much peace and guidance, because of our conversations, and I you know, it's so helpful, and I always feel closer to God. Certainly meeting that fellow who you know, continues to help me with surrendering my thought life. And, you know, just finding OA in general, you know, back in 2005, like, it wasn't that easy to find Overeaters Anonymous. And the idea just literally, you know, came into my brain one day while I was binging, because a family doctor had mentioned it OA to me back in the 90s. And I just literally forgot about it until, you know, 10 years later. You know, another miracle is meeting my husband, who is so patient and loving with me, you know, seeing me really struggle with this work stuff. And, you know, he sees me, you know, in my moments where my mind is just circling the drain about something that's bothering me. And he's so patient, and he doesn't experience, you know, this alcoholic thinking, but yet he offers me so much grace and patience and love. So yeah, you know, I had to keep doing these things, you know, that I didn't want to do with this job, the things I was procrastinating, the tasks I was afraid to do that I didn't want to do imperfectly. And I kept being reminded that being willing to do these things, or anything really, it isn't about a feeling. It's not that I feel willing. It's an action that I take with a dependence on God, with a trust that God loves me and wants to help me. So I got to learn on a deeper level the truth that I actually gain courage and strength when I trudge through each of these experiences that I want to avoid. When I go through them, I trudge through them despite the fear. And I, you know, I get to learn that courage means doing these things while I'm still afraid. And I want to say that throughout this entire process, I have never once thought of eating compulsively or eating off of my meal plan. That is a complete miracle. For someone like me, who before this recovery, when I would feel even the most minor disturbance, you know, at the beginning of the day, let's say, you know, I feel some kind of disturbance, I would tell myself that it was okay to eat my lunch at 10 a.m. That, you know, I would move up my meals because I was looking for even comfort with food. So I would, you know, I'd have my lunch at 10 a.m. And then I'd be like, oh, you know, that was kind of iffy. I probably shouldn't have done that, but whatever. And then, you know, I would continue to feel disturbed. So the food wasn't effective. The feeling of fear or whatever disturbance would come back to me. And then I would have dinner at like 1 in the afternoon. And then I would go, ooh, okay, that wasn't great either. Okay, well, I guess I'm just going to have to stick it out for the rest of the day and not eat again. But of course, that would lead to a binge. So that was, you know, my old way of dealing with much more minor disturbances. So it's honestly a complete miracle that it never occurred to me to eat compulsively. So just thank you, God, for that. And I, you know, it occurred to me that that all of this can be applied to those who are maybe just starting out, who are newly abstinent, or maybe still on the food and looking for recovery, you know, working the steps and becoming willing to surrender in with your food and with doing the spiritual work. It's also an action that is going to be uncomfortable and difficult, but trudging through it leads to a miracle and peace on the other side. It's an action that can be taken with a dependence on God. You know, another way that my mind can compound my fear is that I can start to obsess about tasks in the future, things that I don't have to get done right away. My mind, again, I would get so worried that something in the future is not going to get done. I would obsess about it. And then I couldn't concentrate, or I can't concentrate on the tasks that are right in front of me. You know, I would get distracted and make mistakes on the things that I have to get done right away, because I'm too busy thinking about the future. And, you know, when I was working with this team that I'm having so much trouble with, I would make mistakes, and that, of course, wouldn't help my relationship with them either. You know, it's another way I would set the ball rolling. I would also rush and make errors because I just wanted to, like, get past the things that I didn't like doing that made me feel anxious and afraid. I just wanted to get through them, didn't want to do them anymore, and then I would make mistakes. And, you know, that was my part there. And so I was reminded of the truth that God wants me to be present and just to do what is literally right in front of me. And again, getting these tasks done in those 15-minute increments that I talked about before. And if God is everything, then I can trust that those other things that are I don't need to address until the future will get addressed when the time is right. And I had to become abstinent from thinking about the things that don't have to get done until a day or even a week from now, and that God can only meet me in the moment. I also had to become abstinent from thinking about certain thought topics which weren't helping me or anyone else, and which would again increase my fear. So thoughts like, you know, they think that I'm incompetent. They all think I'm a failure. I'm overwhelmed and I can't do this. Again, my brain would just start circling the drain. The thoughts would become more negative and defeating. There just was no usefulness in that thinking. And it was really hard, but I really had to put those thoughts down, continue to put those thoughts down and become abstinent from them, because they diminish my usefulness. The big book mentions in the chapter How It Works, it says that it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment, or for me also, self-centered fear, leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? So, you know, at the moment where I was about to pick up those defeating and unuseful thoughts again, I asked God, I continue to ask God to remove the fear and show me the next right thought or action. And whenever I would start to get into that self-centered fear again, I would actually send a text to a fellow. I would text her the word squandering. And that was sort of a way for me to surrender, like to signal to somebody else, I'm about to do it again. I'm surrendering. I'm not going to pick up those non-abstinent thoughts. And I just keep doing that over and over again. And then I'm open to more new truths, including that I can actually be helpful by being authentically myself and showing people that I'm imperfect. You know, throughout this process, I have had to be really open with my boss, who I report into, who I really like. I've had to be really open with her that it's just not working out with this other team that I'm embedded with. I had to show her that I was really struggling, which was, you know, one of the first times I've ever been that vulnerable at work. And it's really interesting how, you know, I think people are really starting to respond to me differently. And I'm getting positive feedback about how I'm approachable, how I seem more peaceful. People come to me and say, you know, when I talk to you, it helps me. You know, this is an outside of OA. This is, you know, people in my work life and my outside of my OA fellowship. And I used to get the opposite feedback all the time. People would tell me I was unapproachable. So that transformation is happening. You know, I get to experience the truth that if I do this work of constantly surrendering my fears and my thought life and being in this, you know, this position of surrendering prayer, that God will take care of me. And I find that I'm not doing as many formal 10 steps. I still do them, but it's more like I'm almost living and breathing this program. I think another lie that I'm continuing to surrender is, you know, needing approval from others. You know, that approval seeking. You know, what if they reject me? You know, gosh, I wanted a seat at every table. I wanted everyone to like me. and you know, the voice of the disease is so boring in this respect. I find with the fear and the approval seeking, the voice of the disease is, it's really always saying the same thing. It's so boring. It's this drumbeat of, you're not good enough. Just give up. They're rejecting you. It's the same, you know, 5 to 10 phrases. There's nothing creative or imaginative in that. It's been the same messages for years. There's no solution and that type of thinking. There's just no God in that thinking. But when I go to God, what God tells me is it's always something creative and interesting. It's something I hadn't expected. It's always loving. And there's always a solution. You know, God always shows me the very next step towards something that will improve, you know, my mindset in the situation. And my sponsor and I were just talking about this, that, you know, when I pause and sincerely ask God in, I ask God to remove my fear and my uncertainty about myself, the energy begins to shift and the next right thought or action comes. And I slowly begin to accept myself and my imperfections, which again, for me, is a huge miracle. So I really, you know, I had to continue to confront the dishonesty of wanting to impress others and get my love and validation from them. And really, what's really insane about this situation at work, you know, this team that I was embedded in, these people that I didn't really respect or like very much, you know, I still wanted their approval. And that's insane. You know, normal people aren't like that. My husband would often point that out to me. He's like, you don't even really like these people. but he's just normal in these respects and doesn't get it. But I think many of you do. So I, you know, I was really backed into a corner with this defect of wanting approval from others and really at step one, because I wasn't getting it from this group of people at work. So just like with the food, I had to throw myself into practicing the idea, even though I didn't really believe it, but just practice the idea that I am worthwhile because God loves me. And this work thing, it gave me an opportunity to more deeply surrender what others think of me more than I ever had before. Because I guess if I was still getting even a little bit of approval from people, from humans, then I didn't have to go to God as much. So it's just a reason why this experience has been such a gift for me. Because I'm not as bothered now by the rejection that I experienced from that team. I mean, I still have to spend some time with them. It's not my favorite thing being around them, but I'm not as rattled anymore by the fact that they don't think that I'm awesome. That's such a huge deal for someone like me who can really obsess over whether or not people like me. Yeah, I really get the chance to continue to learn that my worth is determined by God, the God who created me with joy. And this experience has helped me become more grateful for the people in my life who accept me just as I am, especially my, you know, my beloved OA fellows. Yeah, for many years, I did not want to be in this program. I did not want to be the person who was a big book thumper. I wanted to work OA like a side project. You know, I didn't want people to know I was in OA. But now my closest friends are my OA fellows who do not care how well I do at my job. we really, you know, we value each other for who we are and for the God given light inside of each other. Yeah. So I, you know, I'll give you an update on where things are at with my job. You know, my boss who I report into, she, you know, made some attempts to kind of transition me out of working with this team that, I was not having a good experience with. But things weren't moving. That other team wasn't, they weren't, moving along, moving things on their side along to transition me out of that role. So what happened was I had a doctor's appointment. I had some imaging done on my body, like some scans done, not on my heart, but one of the images did pick up an image of my heart, my heart. And the doctor thought that there was a problem with my heart, that was an unusual issue. And I went to my boss and I told her about what was going on with my health, and lots of tests got ordered. And she said, you know what, this is it. This is the signal that we have to make this happen now. We have to move you out of that role right away. If your health is at risk, then we have to move you out. So that got the ball rolling to transition me out of working with that team, that it was not a good fit. Things started to happen really quickly. Finally. And then, I got more medical tests and went to see a cardiologist about my heart. And the cardiologist said, there's nothing wrong with your heart. You're fine. The test was, it was like, we weren't trying to take an image of your heart. It just, it was an inaccurate assessment of that other test, and you're totally healthy. Yeah, I'm getting a little choked up, I guess, when I think about how God has worked in this situation. But the transition out of that unhealthy job continued. It has continued. Thank you, God. I'm just really grateful for how this has transpired. And it's another truth for me personally, is I have to stop chasing satisfaction through, high performance, highly demanding roles at work. It's just, there's so much evidence that that doesn't work for me, and that it's okay for me just to be one of many. And instead, I can feel good about myself by being useful and doing God's will, and basing my trust that God will bring me the purpose that God wants me to have. And I find that that purpose is, it comes from being immersed. A lot of it comes from being immersed in this program, sponsoring, getting ready for this talk and for other, commitments in this program. And I find that, like, it's one thing I found in this experience is that, I started to learn these spiritual principles while I was still feeling really afraid and unsure. But I was getting these opportunities to share commencing to outgrow fear and with other people almost immediately. It's not that I became I didn't become a wise sage on commencing to outgrow fear before I start to get chances to share it with other people who also experienced a lot of fear. I think that's how God works. I feel like I need to have a PhD in something before I can help others. But it's shown me that that is not how God works. And it's kind of similar to, the early alcoholics who were helping each other when they were, sober for only a very short period of time. So it doesn't, this whole experience doesn't mean I still don't have challenges at work. There's still things I have to do that feel really hard. I still have to design slides, but now I'm doing it in a much healthier environment. And when those challenges arise and there's something I need to do that I want to avoid, that I'm scared of, I can ask myself, do I really want to learn how to do this? Do I really want to do a good job and be of service? And when I say, yes, I do, I really do, then I can say, God, okay, then you have to help me. And I find, again, something starts to shift and I get inspiration. Just starting to wrap up here, something that I have discovered is that below this fear, as I commence to outgrow it, it's still there, but I'm outgrowing it. But what I've discovered is that below it, there's actually something deeper. There's a deeper almost disappointment and sadness in God and it's almost like the fear was like more of a surface level distraction from something below that that I really don't want to look at, because it that deeper sadness feels even more insurmountable. So it's something that I'm starting to surrender to, you know, using that same surrendering prayer, like, okay, God, here's an old story where I'm telling myself that my default mode should be that I should be disappointed. Like earlier in my life, I feel like you didn't show up for me. So I'm just going to continue to expect that you're not going to show up for me. I shouldn't get my hopes up. So I shouldn't trust you now. But the truth is that God was always there and I just couldn't see God. So God, please, again, take over my thinking. Remove these thoughts that are misdirecting me. Show me the next right thought or action. So I think with that, I will pass.
Thank you, Jessica. Thanks so much for your vulnerability and for just your authenticity and just giving us a practical view on your journey with regard to fear. And your presentation is going to be a great contribution to the archive. So thank you for that. And a couple of things before we transition to our Q&A. First, let me provide the share ID for Jessica's presentation this morning. That number is 23,607. That's 23607. Second thing, 23607. The second thing is for Jessica's contact information, please stick around till the end of the recorded portion this morning. We will ask Jessica to provide that information at that time. So now let's move on to our Q&A. A great opportunity to pose a question for Jessica. What you're going to want to do is press star one to unmute yourself and give me your first name, and we'll take names of folks who have questions. Who has a question for Jessica this morning?
Avi V, Vancouver,
British
Columbia.
Shanna C.
I got Avi and Shanna. Who else?
Jason KP.
Jason, Christina. I'll tell you who I heard in case you gave your name. Avi, Shanna, Jason, and Christina. Who else?
Kiana in Ohio.
Kiana, we gotcha. Anybody else? Questions this morning? Okay, let's start with this first go around and then we'll kind of see where we're at then. So we've got Avi, Shanna, Jason, Christina, and Kiana. So if you're not Avi, please mute yourself again. And Avi, what question do you have for Jessica this morning?
Thank you so much. Okay, thank you, Jessica, so much for your share. I'm going to do my best to articulate this. My heart is just pounding. You more or less told my story, but of course, different scenario. My question is the deep fear that I need to let go of, that I've recently had this horrendous relapse, and I've been deep in the steps with my sponsor doing some really meaningful work. I have a protector that, as I grew up from various scenarios that I'm not going to go into, but this protector identity that I relied on completely, fully. And even though it doesn't serve me, I've continued to rely on it. And I know that in order to make space for God to truly let go, to really, really let go and let God and surrender, I have to let go of this protector identity. And I don't know how to do that. And I am really curious and interested. And I'm wondering if you have any comment on that, letting go of an idea like that. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the question, Avi. I guess that it sounds to me like that it's like an old defense mechanism, which, you know, for me, it's, you know, it looks a little different, but it's the same story. for me, it would be avoiding or playing the victim was how I would have dealt with that. I guess I can't get wrapped up in figuring it out. I just have to take the action. You know, if it might feel really unusual and foreign and awkward to put down that old protector identity and allow myself to feel vulnerable. Like below that, I guess, would be vulnerability and in allowing people to see that this tough exterior is not the truth, which is going to feel really unusual. It's kind of like early abstinence where it just feels weird to put the food down. It's like what I've always done is to eat compulsively. It just feels weird to eat normally. So I think like it's like picking up that spiritual toolkit, right? It's going to be uncomfortable. There may be pain involved. You're walking on an unusual path. But on the other side of that relatively short-term pain and discomfort and foreign feeling is where the miracle happens. So I hope that's helpful, Avi, and if we can always talk more offline, if that would help you too.
Thanks, Avi, for the question. All right, let's move on to Shanna, followed by Jason. Shanna, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. This is Shanna C., grateful, recovered, compulsive overeater from Tennessee. Thank you for your service, and thank you, Jessica, for graciously sharing from your heart. And I found that when people are properly armed with the facts about themselves, you truly do speak the language of the heart, and that is what I believe honestly happened today. So thank you. My question is, in light of the fact that you have been absolutely blessed, you're a beautiful human being, you have a success story, and when people come to you wanting what you have, because they do, because people are suffering in this program, and then you get overwhelmed. When you mentioned that about being overwhelmed, when you get overwhelmed, at least I do sometimes, because you want to help everybody. So you truly believe, and it is then that I realize at least that it is only through the grace of God that I'm helped. How do you walk through that with grace and dignity without becoming overwhelmed to the point where you're like, I don't know how to help, but yet I'm still going to keep showing up. Even though it seems that people just can't get well at times because there's so few of us that have actually been blessed with this. But we are here to help people, and you've been given power to help others, and you've helped me today. I just want to hear your answer to how do you humbly and confidently continue to show up like you are.
Wow. Thank you for that question, Shanna. Oh, my gosh, what a question. Wow. Because, I mean, I was thinking about the 12 steps the other day that, like, step 12, it brings us back to step one. Like, the steps start where they end where they begin, if that makes sense. I've experienced that the same thing you're thinking about is, trying to help people who the miracle doesn't seem to be happening for them. I think that's what you're trying to say, what you're saying. And I don't do that perfectly, if I'm being honest. I guess like continuing to walk with them, continuing to be available. I have to keep asking God, like, this disease is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I can really see that when I'm working with others, how cunning, baffling, and powerful it is. And I have asked myself the same question, like, why did I experience this miracle, and why isn't it happening for other people too? I wish I had like a kind of a templated answer to give to you, Shanna, but I I don't think I do. I think for me, each, you know, sponsoring situation is different. I have to really stay very closely connected to God when working with others to get guidance on how to help each individual person, because my ego can get in the way so quickly in those scenarios, and I may want to distance myself from people, or I may become too strident, or I may become, you know, not clear enough about guidelines. Like, I'll, again, the two sides of the two twins, like, you know, I can get too strident or I can become a doormat. And I really need God to help me walk on his path, on God's path when helping others, or because I can so quickly slip into one or the other. I heard a really fabulous share from someone yesterday at a meeting. It was around this topic of people who are really seeking recovery and getting out of compulsive eating. And she just kept saying, like, just keep coming back to steps 1, 2, and 3. You know, step one, I'm powerless. I'm really, really powerless over this. Step two, God, I have to believe that you can help me. I've got no other option here. I have to believe that you have a solution despite any prejudice I might have towards you. And step three is like, okay, God, I'm going to do to the best of my ability, discern your will and follow your will here when it comes to compulsive eating. So yeah, that's such a great question, Shanna. Again, I'd love to talk more about it with you if that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Shanna. Okay, next up we have Jason, followed by Christina. Jason, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jason KP from Pennsylvania here. Thank you for your talk. I just want to ask your thoughts on needing validation, or is this instinct, Bill Wilson talks about instincts to belong and to have right relationships with, you know, those about us and true partnership. Is there a legitimate need at times for seeking validation and sort of belonging or acceptance or to be a part of, and how and when does it cross that line into a character defect? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks for the question, Jason. I think so. I think there is a healthy source of validation. You know, I really need to be around other people in this program, because my thinking can get distorted really quickly. I find I hear God through other people. And I think there is a healthy way to be in community with each other. I was at an OA retreat in February, and, you know, it was kind of like in the thick of this really tough work situation. And it felt good to be of service there. It was a perfect place for me to be at that time. And, you know, I was wanting approval from these people at work and not getting it. And I heard God say to me, like, these are your people. Like, those people at work are not your people. These people here at the retreat, these are your people. And, it was a chance for me to really be useful. And it's much more solid ground, I think, to seek esteem in being useful, because it's people can be so fickle, you know, like I say this all the time. People are so fickle. It's a moving target to try to get validation from people. But when I am with people and we are immersed in what I believe is God's will, I'm immersed in doing God's will, that's really solid ground. That doesn't change. It doesn't shift. And I feel like I've tapped into a source of validation that is much more solid and timeless than, you know, the shifting appeal of other people. So anyways, I hope that was helpful. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Okay, Christina, it's your turn, followed by Kiana. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Christina L. from Florida. Thank you so much, Jessica, for your talk. Talk about divine timing and a message, because I'm not usually here on Sunday mornings live. And same for you, Larry. Your opening just like really caught my attention, and it was like a answer to my two-way prayer this morning. I'm also going through a work situation that I need to go back and listen to it from that perspective again. But what was coming up for me today is one of the things, I'm going back through the steps again, and I'm on step one. And one of the things that my sponsor said to me yesterday is she's having a really hard time with me staying in step one. I keep wanting to go here, there, and everywhere and stuff. And she said, you were talking something about powerlessness on Shanna's, I think it was Shanna's share and stuff. But how do I word this question? Like, how do I do step one when I never relapsed the first time? I mean, I relapsed in my thinking for sure, but I never acted out on the behaviors that were coming. But in going through the steps again, I'm looking at the way the disease manifests in me in a completely different way. And one of the things that came up for me this morning was reaching out to other people and asking this question, like, how do you do powerlessness in step one when you've already been through the steps? There's that desire, like Hilary's question was, do I reveal or conceal and stuff? So it's like not wanting other people to see the mess that I'm in right now. I don't know if you can do anything with that question, but thanks.
Okay. So it sounds like you're at step one with, not with the food, but with there's some unmanageability, like a character defect situation. Where you're at.
No, they're a little bit, but also with step one, because before I've always focused on a compulsive overeating, but what has come up is my restricting. I've had food added back in, and so that's where that, yeah, hopefully that makes more sense. So a little bit of both.
Yeah, I guess maybe Christina, I have more questions than answers about that situation. So maybe you and I could, if that would be helpful, we could have like an offline conversation, just because I think I just have a lot of questions, a bit more questions to ask you before I feel like I could be helpful. That would be all right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. And Christina, yeah, hang out till the end here. We'll get, we're going to get Jessica's contact information too, so you can reach out to her. So let's move on. Kiana, it's your turn with the question. Good morning. Kiana, press star one.
Sorry about that. This is Kiana in Ohio. Thank you for your service and an awesome share. My question, outside of doing the prayer that your sponsor had you read, you know, to say daily, I was curious if you did a formalized way through your 12 steps, like a 12-step exercise, like every time you had a fear at work, or was it just through like praying and doing 10 steps? So yes, if you can just explain, like, was it a formal, like steps 1 through 12 in this fear for work? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Kiana. I didn't do a formal, I did a lot of 10 steps. I said, I did the surrendering prayer again almost constantly every 15 minutes. I didn't do like a whole 12 step or steps 1 through 12 writing. The fellow that I was working with who helped me with that prayer, you know, our talk and our work together, it was, the steps were sort of all working together. So it wasn't like okay, I'm going to do step 1 now, writing on that, step 2, writing on that. It was more that the steps, again, were all sort of working together. And I guess with my work, things can be really dynamic and changing all the time. I'm sure that's the way a lot of us work nowadays, that I needed prayers and things that I could do that were quite agile. And I found that, you know, that prayer that I mentioned earlier, I have it written on an index card. I'm looking at it right now. It was something that can work in a pinch. You know, and I was reminded that that God is in my inhale, that I can breathe in and God comes in on my inhale. Because I would really love to just stop and pause everything and do a lot of writing, but it doesn't. That has so much value, and there is absolutely a place for that. But I guess for me, the situation, because I really want to make everything an academic exercise, but in this situation, I needed something that I could use in the moment to help me, and really again place me in a situation where help me be in a position of almost constant surrender. So yeah, thanks for the question, Kiana. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, thanks, Kiana. Well, we still have time for perhaps a couple, three more questions if they are out there. If you have a question, press star 1 and give me your first name.
Jennifer C.
Okay, Jennifer, gotcha.
Denise.
Was that Janine? Denise. Okay, Denise.
Denise, please.
Thanks, Denise.
Thank you.
Yep, we got you. Anybody else?
Suri C.
Hey, Suri. Good morning to you. Let's stop with Suri. Okay, let's see where we're at that point. So we got Jennifer, Denise, followed by Suri. Let's start with the question from Jennifer. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Jessica, thank you so much. That was so clear, so beautiful, so good. And my question is this. I heard you allude to the fact that the more you live in 6 and 7, and correct me if I'm wrong and you didn't actually say this, but what I heard was the more you implement the spirit of 6 and 7, the less you have to do 10s. Can you share more about that with me?
Yes, I did say that because there was a time where I was doing, and I know, like, I know that this works for other people too, but there was a time where I was doing 10 steps like multiple times a day, writing them out, using other methods. And again, I know that offers a lot of help and value to lots of people, but I just find for me now, I'm sort of in this more of a position of being more like starting out surrendered, again, imperfectly. So the need for more these formal 10 steps, I find I don't have to do them as much. I'll be totally honest with you though. I did one this morning, early this morning with another fellow because I was really nervous about this talk. There's people who are, you know, might hear this who know that I would do 10 steps on my job nearly, they would happen every day. I would do 10 steps on my job every day. This was when I was doing work that I liked doing. but I still had to do these 10 steps all of the time. And then this situation was so challenging for me that I just feel like I was put in this, I chose to pick up this spiritual toolkit more vigorously, and I feel like I'm in this position now where I don't have to do them as much. It's like this constant surrendering position, which I'm grateful for. Again, there's the old lies. I have to avoid difficult situations. They're painful. But it's turned out to be such a gift because I feel like it has deepened my spiritual growth. So, yeah, thanks for the question, Jennifer.
Yeah, thanks so much. Okay, let's move on to Denise, followed by Suri. Denise, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, OA family. I heard God throughout, at least just throughout your articulate and authentic, very clear words, Jessica. My question to you is very much a very simple, although intuitive question. I liked that you named your presentation Commencing to Outgrow Fear. My question is, why did you not name it We Commenced to Outgrow Fear? So putting it in the present as opposed to the past, as the big book says those words.
I don't know if I really put a lot of thought into the tense of the grammatical tense of it. I am continuing. I have not outgrown fear. It is absolutely a continuing journey for me. it's a practice. It's not, there's no end in, there's no, it's not over yet. That's for sure. It probably will never be over for me personally. I'm commencing to outgrow fear. And I guess what I had hoped to convey is the spiritual actions that help me, you know, do this more rigorously, and the truths that I've learned and the peace that I have gained. But I definitely still experience fear. Life, I always want it to just be over with. I really do. It's like, when is this going to end? And I think I've reached some kind of, I guess what Bill talks about is like, I want to arrive, you know, in Bill's story. I want to arrive. And as soon as something seems to like get more peaceful and things are feeling easier, you know, almost immediately some new challenge arises. And I'm like, I wasn't expecting that. Okay. All right, here we go again, you know? And, each time I find, you know, there's a new situation that where my fear could flare up, it doesn't rattle me as much. I still feel somewhat like rattled, but not as deeply destabilized as I have been. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, thanks. Me too. Ditto, ditto. Okay, our final question is coming from, hey, Suri, good to hear you. Good morning.
Good morning. Wow, I want to thank you for your share and thank my higher power for this, for checking in this morning. My question to you is, I believe that you shared this, but it was so triggering to me that I blanked some of what you shared out. How do you feel like there was a moment in which you felt like you were walking side by side with fear instead of being run by it with the food? I'm asking because as I've done this program, I still haven't had abstinence, and I've reached a point where I'm like afraid of a sponsor even. And I used to call and just go through that. So how, like, do you feel like there was a point where you were walking side by side with fear a little bit more? And then also, is there a way to sit, like, to be grateful for the fear? How would you suggest expressing gratitude for the fear with, especially with regards to the food and the unmanageability?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Suri. I mean, the fear, without the fear, again, that pride, that other side of the coin, that other twin would be in charge, I guess, would maybe the two balance each other out. But I know for sure that feeling fear brings me closer to God. I mean, it makes me desperate, just like I was with food. And I had to just be like, I am out of options here, God. You have to help me. It brings me very close to God. So I guess that is the benefit of it. And it helps me be vulnerable. And I'm being shown more and more that when I'm vulnerable, I'm actually being helpful to others. I'm helping others see that they're not alone in feeling fear. So I guess it connects me. It breaks me out of my isolation. Connects me to other people. And then I think your question was walking side by side with the fear instead of being run by it and it controlling me. Yes. I mean, there are many moments where I feel the fear. But I take the action anyways. Again, that old lie that I shouldn't take action until the fear is gone is not true. And that courage means taking action while feeling the fear, trudging through the fear, and that there is peace on the other side. And I guess that's my ideal nowadays is, though I feel the fear, I take the action anyways. Though it feels unusual, feel my disease is telling me it's the wrong thing to do and I should just give up, I take the action anyway. And it feels, again, really unusual because it's such an old pattern to let the fear control me and keep my life small. But when I take the action and it feels uncomfortable, life always gets better. It always gets better. It always gets bigger and more interesting, more possibilities. And the fear begins to diminish. It never completely goes away, but it's no longer controlling my life. So I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, thanks, Suri. And thanks to everyone who posed a question this morning, or if you're just on the line this morning. And a special thanks to Jessica C. from Ontario, Canada. So appreciative, Jessica. I'm glad you didn't let the fear paralyze you this morning. You got up, you did service, and you can feel good about it because it was very helpful to me for sure. And I have a feeling a few others as well. So with that, I'm going to give you the share ID for the presentation this morning. That number again, 23,607. That's 23607. And we're going to now close up and then we'll get Jessica's contact information after that. But I'm going to read from page 164 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our namesake chapter, A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.